It's Wednesday, September 7th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 245 of Hear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 47 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
This is John.
And this is Chris.
John, your Blood Moon Goblins thing.
Yay, goblins. We are holding at about 1,600 as of the recording of this video. Nice. That is above our goal of 1,200, so the Blood Moon Goblins is financed and will be produced. I made an update post shortly after we cleared the funding. I will spend the extra monies as best I can on the project. Although, if growth continues at this rate, I'm going to have enough money to do two projects. I don't know what the future holds, other than it definitely holds Blood Moon Goblins. At this moment, Keith Curtis is doing my first two art orders, so I should be out with an advertisement piece relatively soon, especially relatively soon to the time that this episode drops, and also we're working on a logo. We're in production.
Right, and so if you're interested in contributing to this, it is still open. You can still get all the prizes and awards and whatnot for doing your contribution. And John does have plans for the overages, so don't hesitate if you're interested to get out to Blood Moon Goblins and to donate there.
Bloodmoongoblins.com.
Yep.
$5 pre-orders the PDF, $20 pre-orders the written version and PDF with shipping anywhere in the U.S. And up from there, you start getting crazy rewards. Episode minus one has been sold, so that is gone. But room for custom goblins to go in the setting and the John GM'd campaign are still up for sale.
Yeah, that's one of the cool things about Kickstarter is it is a great tool to just pre-order something.
Yeah, and that's essentially what the first two tiers are. I mean, I'm selling it to you for what it costs before it comes out.
Two other things I want to mention is, first off, once again, Fear the Boot will in all probability be appearing at the Game Convention, just G-A-M-E Convention, in Springfield, Missouri, October 7th through 9th. I'm still trying to work with the guys there because they have a D&D game on the nights we record. So I'm trying to work out something with them to get them on the mics, because what I really want to talk about is 1984, which is the 1980s video arcade that they operate. And I'm also going to see if I can get them to open it up for us while we're down there so that I can get in there and have my Gorf tournament with any booters that are around. But if you're interested in checking out that convention, there's a very good chance that Fear the Boot will be attending that. And last of all, if you intend to play Star Wars The Old Republic, we have formed a guild. And it's kind of neat because what they're doing is you can actually form your guild prior to the game's release. And if enough people in the guild enter their pre-order codes, which is a threshold we have now hit, then that guild will actually carry over into the game. They will pick a server for us that fits our requirements, put the guild into it, and when you start the game, you get a little pop-up says, hey, do you want to stay in the guild you're already in? And if so, you go straight to our group.
It is kind of a unique idea, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I guess mainly there haven't been, I guess, that many new MMOs that have popped up lately, but I would expect to see this kind of thing from now on with new MMOs.
Well, especially because MMOs,
it's nice to be able to form your guild before you're in game, going, standing around going, okay, hey, sign a charter, 10 gold for anybody to come sign my charter.
Well, and also MMOs live and die on social attachment.
Yeah.
And so they're helping you build that social attachment prior to the game's creation. So,
speaking of that, it's kind of cool because the Star Wars site, when you sign up for your guild, you get your own guild website on there, you know, on the StarWars.com. And with that, you have the general information about the guild, but it also has a public and a private forum. Now, we don't really need that as much because there's a forum dedicated to it's a Star Wars The Old Republic House Nakash on our forums. It's down toward the bottom. It's actually right underneath the WoW Guild forum. So we've got that there, but it's nice to have because not everybody has that, and we could start using it on that site as well too.
So if you intend to play The Old Republic and are looking for a guild or are willing to run with us, I will put the link in the show notes so you can go out to the Old Republic website and actually sign up for the guild on that website, which will for real put your first character into our guild, which is pretty freaking cool. And in case you're worried that we won't stick with this game very long, I will go ahead and tell you that Pat is running this guild and he has a proven track record, we do not, of sticking with games. So he's been running the WoW Guild now for quite some time. Yeah. And so if you have no confidence in the rest of us in terms of having an ability to stick with the game, Pat is there to save you where we have failed you. So anyway, I will put that link in the show notes. Let's move on to other things. All right. I got a rant this week. I know I've had a couple lately, but I got one today as well. games need pronunciation guides. Here's what got me thinking about this. John's sitting here flipping through the third edition Forgotten Realms book, which, by the way, I think was one of the better books they put out for third edition.
Yeah, it's got pronunciation next to its NPCs.
Yeah, and it should, because here's the thing. It was him reading that book that got me thinking about this, because the elves with dark skin, drow or drow?
Drow.
Drow.
Really?
I always went drow.
I always went drow, yeah.
Wayne?
That's all I've ever heard.
I have never seen the word before right now.
If I showed you the word D-R-O-W, how would you pronounce it?
Drow.
Hmm.
See, and here's the thing. I'm sure somebody listening to this is like, no, I know what the correct pronunciation is because I sat on a con panel with so-and-so who came up with them, and this is how he or she said that
we
the race
name is. We have half the gaming industry in our Skype Rolodex. We can settle this once the
episode
is over.
That's true. We probably could just make a Skype call to the right person and find out the true answer.
Pronunciations have always been a big pet peeve of mine, because especially in like comic books or books, I'll read something.
Yeah.
I'll take what I think the pronunciation is and then find out that this whole group of people have their own pronunciation.
I know.
And I've now been used to calling it this for 10 years.
And doesn't that throw you? I hate when that happens.
I
do the same
too.
Thing.
Or you know, they'll do a TV then, adaption or a video
right,
game adaption.
You'll come
you'll
there'll
hear
be
it.
Some more formal or an accepted pronunciation of it from somewhere. It's like, God damn it, that's not the way I pronounce it for a decade.
Yeah, and people treat you like an idiot for not knowing the right way to pronounce something that you've discovered in your basement.
And I don't know why games couldn't just put next to their proper nouns or have a little appendix or something in the back of all the proper nouns followed by
a phonetic.
Yeah, exactly. Of how this name should be pronounced, because you are using these conversationally. You're not just reading this. You're then turning around and saying these names at the table or at conventions. And then, yeah, you end up with 2, 3, 25 different pronunciations of the same word. And I don't know, I probably shouldn't bother me because who cares? It's a fictitious word, but it just drives me nuts. I hate not knowing how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Or then you look like a dumbass because apparently there is an agreed upon pronunciation that you just haven't heard. And
that's my big thing when it comes to a movie being made out of like a sci-fi book that I've read or a fantasy book or something. There's always a bunch of words that I came up with something different reading it. And it just drives me crazy because everyone seems to, oh, yeah, that's pronounced like this.
It's because you've got a level of personal investment in it because you enjoy it. You know, it's the same thing. I mean, when it comes to Battletech, when I first heard somebody say, no, the correct pronunciation is Liao. And I'm like, are you kidding me? It sounds so much better as Lio. And or same thing with Davian, which is pronounced Davian and not Davian, like I would pronounce it. But you've got that personal investment in that property. And you know, like you said, you've been pronouncing it that way for about a decade. And then you get somebody correcting you and it just doesn't feel right.
Damn it. I've only been calling it Davian 2 weeks. I'm not going to change now.
See? Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. You got the investment in there. I know. To me, it's always been Davian.
Lich. It's not Lick. Everyone who thinks it's Lick, get out.
Right.
I hear
people say an undead Lick.
That is probably the worst name for an undead is to call, especially to a bunch of horny gamers, is to call it Lick. You're just asking for trouble. Yeah. All you're doing is taking away any ferocity that monster has. I'm sorry, you're what? You're a Lick?
Maybe I'll finally get a Lick when I get 16 levels of Necromancer and die.
A Draco Lick. I'm like, really? No, my favorite, I think one of the ones that I always bitched about and had so much fun with was, speaking of the drow, is the most infamous, horrible one that was ever created was D-R-I-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z. Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-T.
Drizzt Do'Urden?
Yeah, how the f*** do you say? I always said Drizzt.
You're just mad because
it's actually not Drizzt. It's like,
statue,
I think
statue dislocated Drizzt. The Sarah Angel statue. And Sarah Angel's tits are bigger than Drizzt's tits.
That's true. I'm not sure how tits came of that, but tits are never a bad thing.
My favorite one from a comic book standpoint is there's a Superman villain, Mr. Mixixpidalic. There is no vowels in the name at all. It was spelled differently in Bolton. It was spelled differently.
Because
at least
that's not right, is it?
Kill Pixiesm.
Because at least in the animated series,
Olek Enar,
he actually breaks down
okay,
how
Wayne's
to pronounce
here,
his
guys.
Name.
Mm,
yeah. That's right.
He says it's this like this, this like this, this like this. He actually breaks
the
down and teaches
from
you.
The comic
yes, Gilbert
community
Godfrey
when he
tells
did
you
that.
How to pronounce that name correctly.
The outrage and from the comic community when he did that, because it wasn't how a lot of people pronounced it, just
I
knew
think,
no vowels.
I'll say, I think that's where because I think it was Mixixaplix, and it was, because
no.
I think that's the way I figured out how to do it was from the animated series.
Yeah, but Here's the thing. A comic book, obviously, it's written word, but what's the written word? It's voice bubbles. These are people talking. Obviously, in that world, somebody's pronouncing the name, so there is a pronunciation.
Mm-hmm. It was different in Lois and Clark from where it was in the cartoon, but it drives me crazy because there's four or five different ways to pronounce it. I don't care how someone pronounces it, but that's the big one for me because there's no vowels. There is not a correct way to pronounce something that has a vowel
Y sound.
Yeah, that's right. Just ask any gypsy.
By the way, I think this episode's going to be a small topic roundup because it looks like what we've got here is a whole bunch of topics. We don't think any of them are going to go for like 30, 40 minutes. So we're probably going to hit several RPG topics that are each going to be about 10 to 20 minutes in length.
Or the first one will last 2 hours and we won't understand.
Yeah, or we'll just lose our way in a rant on the first one. But let's see what happens here. This first one, actually speaking of pronunciation disagreements, comes from a guy on our forums whose name is Thaco, or is it Thaco? I've always gone Thaco because it's A as an armor.
Thaco is wacko.
It's actually it's pronounced two hit armor class zero.
Well, that's what it stands for. But
no, that's the way it's pronounced as well.
Oh, okay.
You just have to say it really fast, and then it comes out Thaco.
I've always swung on both sides of the fence on that one.
Yeah, I believe
we've heard that about you, Chris.
He asked a question on the forums about getting other players in the group to take on leadership positions. I am going to frame this in two ways. There are some role-playing games or some setups where an explicit leader is required. You're playing a military group. You're playing a kingdom. Somebody has to be in charge. You're playing a corporation. There has to be a point man. But I think in every group, there is still going to be an implicit leader. There's going to be someone that the group kind of hinges on, that they turn to for a tie-breaking vote, that in role-playing is the most socially dominating person. And of course,
called the loud guy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The explicit leader almost always ends up being either A, the one guy that's willing to take it on, or B, the loud guy. And while sometimes A might be nepotism, you know, it's the GM's brother. I was guilty of doing this. A lot of times A and B are the same thing. The most socially dominating person is the guy who always ends up with leadership, so he gets it anyway. And the implicit leader, it is almost invariably the loudest guy at the table. It has nothing to do with the characters. But as much as it should, the inevitability is, at least in my observations, it isn't. So how do you get somebody who's not otherwise comfortable playing the leader, or maybe feels intimidated by it because they'll feel they'll make bad decisions or don't know the setting all that well, to step up, do something different, and take on the role of leader so you don't have the same guy being the captain of the starship in every single Star Trek game you run?
You know, I want to hear Pat's take on this first because
I was about to talk before you cut me off.
Tend to make you leader. Like, if you'll notice in a lot of the games, you have been the designated leader of the group, but you're usually not the
Chad.
You're usually not Chad, or in this game, Dan. Someone else has actually taken the leadership role while you're in charge.
But I'm the game master. Why did you say the Dan? In the last game, okay.
Yeah, in the last game, you weren't the game master, but you were leading, even though he was the designated leader. Before that, he was the designated leader.
Okay, that is true. Gnarl did tend to be out front. Okay, that is a fair point.
Interestingly enough, I have found in a lot of my games that I've played that I usually am in the leadership position, but I'm one of those, I guess I'm what I like to call the...
You lead from the rear.
Well, I do, but I'm not the one that says, I want to be the leader and I'm going to play the leader and I'm going to be the one that tells everybody what to do. You know, it is sort of kind of sometimes a de facto thing and I don't mind, but I don't usually go seeking to be the leader because maybe somebody else in the group wants to be the leader. So, and if that's the case, awesome. I don't want to just jump out there and be the leader if somebody else really wants to. Now, in a group where you're established like we are now, I think it's kind of been decided more so that, okay, yeah, maybe not necessarily anybody else really wants to be the leader, so it's not a big deal. But certainly if you're in a newer group and there are players that you're not as familiar with, you know, I think you should be more cognizant of the fact that maybe if you're playing the leader all the time, maybe somebody else does want to. But to answer your question originally about how do you get people to step up, first of all, I think you need to talk to those people and find out if they really want to or not, because if they truly do not want to be a leader, I mean, let's put it this way.
It'll be an upsetting experience.
They're chiefs and they're Indians.
Yeah.
And you know what? You cannot have a successful group run that's all chiefs. A chief has to have some Indians.
Yeah, that's called True Dungeon.
Yes. Don't get me started, John.
This is serious business.
Oh my God. But you know, so that's the first thing is, you know, do a poll, talk to people and say, hey, you know, or if you've noticed that one person in particular says that you think, a leadership role might be a good thing for them. It might help bring them out of their shell or give them a better experience in role playing. You know, sit down and talk with them and get their feeling for it and see what they think. I mean, maybe they're scared shitless to do it and they don't want to do it. Or maybe they thought, well, you know, I just never did because, you know, John always liked to be the leader. And I'm cool with that. Well, you know.
Yeah. And I do absolutely agree with you that you should never force a leadership role upon someone who's not just a little hesitant or a little bit sheepish, but outright doesn't want it.
Right.
Because if they're going to be uncomfortable in it, they're not going to have a good time. It's going to drag the whole group down. I think you've got to do a two-pronged thing. One is, as you said, address the person who is a little bit more quiet. The second thing is address the person who's too loud.
Yes. But
one of the things that I thought was great as we're setting up this BattleTech game was we were trying to pick, well, okay, it's a command structure. It's a military. Somebody has to be the ranking officer. And Chad was actually one of the first people to say it should be Wayne. Now, mind you, Wayne is fairly quiet in RP. He has never played BattleTech as a campaign before. You've played some like one-shot skirmishes. Yeah. You've never played as an RPG. You know pretty much nothing about the setting. And Chad threw out there, and we as a group supported, hey, you know what? The most likely people to grab this role is everyone but Wayne.
Yes.
And so let's get Wayne to do it. And you were on board with that. And so it just took a certain amount of, I don't want to say social pressure, but it was kind of social pressure from the group to say, we should let Wayne do this.
You know, I've seen in a lot of instances, it isn't the person that wants it most that necessarily gets nominated by the other players. It's the person that would be fine with it, but would never stand up and say,
exactly,
this is what I want. Because that's the kind of person you want in that role.
Well, and failing all else, look, the Game Master is the de facto boss. The Game Master can, at the start of the game, once again, unless this is really going to upset the group as a whole, just say, okay, this time around, Jane is going to be the leader. Jane's never the leader. She's too quiet. This time around, she's going to be the leader. You just kind of push that off on them. If you're a player in the game, then I think this is where the peer pressure comes in. If you kind of nudge so-and-so, not in an ignorant way, but say, hey, I've got confidence in you. What do you think? You should really kind of be running this, you know, or if they're not comfortable running the entire game, you know, or being in charge throughout the whole campaign, you just get them to start taking over situations. You know, hey, you've got all the social skills. I want you to run this negotiation. I'm just going to step back and let you handle
it. That's true. It could be situational.
That was the point that I was going to make here, is that it wasn't so much what it sounded like that you were pressuring Wayne to do it, but it was more of a supportive way. You know, you're backing him up, saying essentially what you just said. We believe that you can do this, and gives that person a sense that even if I, as the leader, make some bad decisions, because you've all supported me as a leader, you're gonna back me up on that, and you're gonna roll with the good and the bad that ends up happening from me being put into this position. You know, you're giving them that implicit stuff up front, saying, "Hey, you know, it's cool. Don't worry about it. It's just a game. We're gonna have a good time."
And that was something that I tried to do in the D&D game we just played. Was, while in terms of RP, I'm generally not a terribly quiet person, and playing a gnoll, I was very out in front. He was very proactive. But I wrote the character such that he had this sense of subordination to Pat's character. And so he might step out front and take care of the action. But when someone said, well, you have to make a decision about whether you're going to choose A or B, he would turn around and defer back to Pat's character and say, well, that's ultimately up to him. Mm-hmm. And I would kind of force Pat to step forward and take control of the situation. I would not just keep on bulldozing and run the situation through. You know, I had the character built such that he would keep deferring back to somebody else for certain levels of leadership decisions. Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, you talked about the group kind of having patience with a new leader. And I absolutely think that's important, because if the person's already a little hesitant to take the leadership position, and then you crucify them for every little mistake they make, that's not positive reinforcement. Google baby Albert, and that's effectively what you're doing to this person. The other thing I would throw in with that is the Game Master also has to make those exceptions. Wayne does not know BattleTech. So when it comes to a particular situation where there's a group that shows up that Wayne has never even heard of, and he's about to do something that would deeply offend them and cause unending war, I have to give Wayne the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, time out. Let me give you a little quick backstory on this group. Or, hey, fair warning, what you just said is probably going to be interpreted this way. You might want to reconsider that. Or if you do something and it's too late to take it back because the game rolled right past it, say, okay, in truth, this would get a response at a level 10 but I'm going to have them respond with a level 4 where there is just indignation because I recognize you don't understand what you just did.
No, total party kill. Only way they learn.
Exactly. If you make a strategic mistake. In Battletech, that's a big deal. You make a tactical mistake on the battlefield. Yes, as an experienced Battletech player, I could take you to the cleaners on that. But what I have to do is, as the game master, say, no, I'm not going to have the NPCs play at that level because Wayne's not yet playing at that level.
Besides, I could just send in wave of, after wave of Chad's characters. I'll be set.
That's right.
Just to make sure we cover this from every angle, I think one of the things in that post that they were asking about, too, was situations where you don't necessarily have a defined command structure. It's just every situation you get into, you've got one person taking the lead and running with the situation.
Well, would you answer that, though, a whole lot differently? I don't think I would. I think that the choice of one person to step up and the choice of other players to quiet down, followed by the peer pressure of, hey, you ought to step up and do this, I really think would accomplish the same thing in an implicit leadership structure. I mean, do you agree? Do you disagree?
I think that if a group has good cohesion, that they can do that. You know, if you're very comfortable with yourself, like in our group, I think we can do that pretty easily, but maybe not in every group. They would be able to do that as well.
Yeah. And the other players may not realize that there's anything off. If one person is always the front man, that just may be what they take as normal, especially if they were newer gamers. If you have a whole group of fairly new gamers, they may not realize that it would be a good idea for them to step up occasionally.
Well, I got to think, though, there's kind of a presupposed truth in Thacko's question, which is, if he's asking the question, how do you get people to step up to leadership roles? Obviously, someone in the group is aware that person A is always the leader and person B is never the leader. Somebody's aware of the problem here, whether the boisterous guy's aware of how boisterous he is or the quiet guy's aware of how quiet he is. Obviously, someone at the table realizes the imbalance.
You know, another way that I think that you can accomplish this, often character classes will have something about them that would make them more of a leadership role than others.
Like, yes,
a classic example is the paladin. I mean, if you play the paladin in the party, you are pretty much the de facto leader of the party just by the way the class is written. And I know that not every system has that, but
or you're the antagonized would-be leader of the party who's constantly thrown out, which is the better paladin.
Like that. But, like, you know, at the same time, the kind of thing you've got, and you've got somebody that wants to be the leader, then you don't want them to be playing a much more timid class that's never going to really, be known to step up.
Bards can be leaders. Anything with a jacked charisma is generally predisposed to the leader's skills and feats, whether or not they actually should lead.
Going on what you're saying, though, that's kind of one of the ways I was thinking about it. It all depends on how covert and passive aggressive you want to be about it. If the rest of the party wanted someone who doesn't normally take up a leadership role to take up the leadership role, those people could conspire to create essentially, you know, characters that aren't of that dominant nature that you're describing, and then essentially force that person into that leadership role.
I guess you want to force them, but I mean, but like I said, you know,
it's like the old visual guy you see in a lot of military movies where they ask for volunteers instead of one guy stepping forward, everybody else steps back.
But like, you know, like I'm saying, I guess what in that situation, if you're wanting somebody to play the leader of the party, you don't necessarily want them to say, okay, well, my character is the stealth rogue that's always in hiding in shadows. I mean, that's
my character's
kinda,
the druid that won't leave the woods.
Yeah, it's
good. You guys have fun.
That kind of flies
months.
In the face of, you know, you're supposed to be the out front and command person.
I think the game could be the secret ruler and have a dummy face. I've seen that done before. You
know, the day that Chad makes a mime is the day I know he's trying to give us a message.
you're stuck in a box.
You may be dead. You may not be dead.
It doesn't feel that windy out.
You're a cat. What are you?
I think the game master can also help with this a little bit in the middle of the game by throwing out certain situations. If you have someone who's never taken on a leadership role, and this is not a game that has an organized command structure, let's go back to D&D. Let's say the cleric's being super quiet. You can still have the game master say, okay, the peasant comes up to the party and says, I must speak with your priest. And will only confide in the priest exactly what is going on at this point in time. And only wants the priest's insight on what they should do. This forces the person into a role where they have to lead. And the NPC, by the nature of who they are, will not listen to anyone else or won't believe anyone else. And so the boisterous, obnoxious guy up front can't get anywhere with this person. Because you know what? the folks in your world, NPCs, friend, enemy, neutral, all alike, they can be just as boisterous as anyone in your party.
No, I agree with you. That is a good way to try and, you know, coax some more out of that person and get them comfortable in that role by giving them those little miniature spotlight opportunities. Absolutely.
For our next topic, I want to hit on one that I was actually thinking about saving till last, with the idea that if we didn't get to this episode, maybe we'd make that the banter topic next episode. But I just have to do it this episode because we're coming off so fresh from a Chris episode. And by episode, I don't mean a podcast recording. I mean in the same way you might have like a psychotic episode.
It's funny you should mention that because I was thinking about that. I don't. Honestly, just as a personal preference, I don't say goddamn very much. I really don't. You know, I always grew up, my dad never swore at all. And so when he swore, then you knew that there was trouble. I mean, because he just didn't. My mom swore all the time. My dad never. And so I realized last week I must have dropped did I drop three or four of those? I don't know. I kind of got, everything got blurry. And then
did you just say that your mother swore all the time? Was she like, she swore like a sailor?
She was a little bit like that. There's one time I remember specifically, she was coming in after shopping or something like that. And she's hauling in groceries. I'm sitting there not helping at all, as was my usual, as was my usual normal lazy self. I was such a lazy shit when I was a kid. Anyway, so she comes in and she looks and she's like, oh my gosh, we got so much shit. And then she looks at me and she goes, that's really such a great word, isn't it? And then she just keeps on walking.
How old are you at this time?
I think I was like about 9 or 10 or something like that.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So, and I realized I dropped all kinds of GDs last week. And I mean, you know, it was just a little. Sorry. Anyway,
you're
yeah.
You're in rage timer, dude. You got +4 strength, but -2 wisdom. It happens to all of us.
Chris, if you get angry and black out for periods of time,
it makes great podcasting.
But you might want to get some counseling. Julie may not be walking into door frames as much as you think.
But I just removed the carpeting on our stairs. So yeah, that.
Or backing into them as the case may be.
You'll never guess what happened. Anyway.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So the topic that I want to talk about, this one was put forward by Jahili. I'm just guessing on the pronunciation of that name. I have no idea.
I think it's Jahili.
Jahili?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Red Boba Fett. That's the avatar she uses. So we'll just go with Red Boba. I think it's a Boba Fett. I have no idea.
It's a girl Mandalorian or human who dresses like a Mandalorian. I don't remember her name.
Okay.
But yeah, it's Red Boba Fett.
Red Boba Fett. Right. The concept she threw forward, and this is actually kind of a cool idea, is rewarding players for carrying a little extra water. Chris's rant last time was about players who won't write backgrounds, read setting information, read rules, et cetera, et cetera. And I've talked in the past about how I can't stand baby bird players who want you to go out, find the worm, eat the worm, digest the worm, barf it into their mouth, as all they do is sit there open mouthed in the nest. Mm. What Red Boba Fett threw out was the idea of basically giving them a carrot or giving them rewards for carrying a little extra water. And she specifically put it in the context of homework, that you say, look, if you'll go home, and these are examples I'm making up, not ones she gave, but if you'll go home and write out some notes from this game, or give me a little bit more to work with in your character's background, or give me some NPCs I can use for next time, or whatever the case is, but get this person to carry a little bit of water, then you say, I'm going to reward you in the game. Now, that reward could be simply you get the RP spotlight more often, but it could also be like, look, I want you to come up with 3 goals for your characters and 3 hindrances that they're facing. And I think it was Bai Shen who threw out this list of, what was it, goals, hindrances, and things that would keep you from achieving that goal or something to that effect. If you can give those to me, I will give you an XP reward, or I will see to it that you come across an extra item or something like that. Or if there's something I know you've been looking for in this campaign, whether it's a material reward or an opportunity or a moment of RP or whatever it is, I'm going to make that happen for you as a reward for being willing to get off your ass and do more than just show up and phone it in from your chair.
I have no problem with that.
Yeah, that sounds great to me.
I know that was going to be Chris's wet dream. I would say I think it sounds great, but I'm going to devil's advocate here just a little bit. Not to say I actually think it's a good idea, but at the same time, here's what I foresee that you could run into. You are going to have those players out there that, again, are Chris's wet dream players that love to do this kind of shit. They just get off on it. That's the kind of thing that they do anyway. So, you know, you might have those players that they do that anyway. They do it all the time. So like you throw that at them, they're like, oh, okay, here's 5 pages. Where's my shiny? And then you've got the other players that, you know, the more normal players, as Johan and I would put them, that really don't want to do this and see it as, okay, this doesn't really do anything for my role play. It's nothing to help me buy in or whatever. I like to play at the table. I don't want to have homework that I have to do for a game, yada, 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 whatever. And so they're not going to do it. So the problem that I see there is that in trying to reward those players that don't do that, they're just not going to do it. But the ones that do it anyway are just getting more and more rewards.
So, wait,
you know, I mean, that's
what you're
that's
saying
what I
here
sort of see
is
there.
That it's a bad idea to reward people who are willing to get off their ass and do something.
No, what I think with Pat and Pat, I don't mean to speak for you because I know you like that stuff. But what I think Pat means to say is that there are going to be some who don't want to do that. And you don't want to sit there and start to over reward those who do get off on doing that, because they're going to start to unbalance things in a certain sense, because they're going to just keep doing stuff to get more and more and more and more.
If you put it that way.
Thank you, Chris. You actually did, I guess, say it in a way that at least Dan understands, okay, that I wasn't able to convey.
My thoughts are you get out of the game what you put into it.
I agree with you in that sense, Pat, because if you do this kind of thing, you got to come at it in a very minimalist fashion. If somebody comes and, you know, does just a journal of last week's session, so you have good, nice, accurate, and interesting to read notes. You know, you can't be handing out 1,000 XP to this guy or some major reward for what they did. It's got to be balanced. And the only way you can determine what that balance is at the table and what works for your campaign.
I guess the way I look at it is going back to like grade school, junior high, high school. It was the extra credit assignments where the teacher would say, if you write a paper on this, I'll give you extra credit points. You don't have to do it. You can still get a 100% A+ in this class without doing it. But if you do this, I'll give you something a little bit extra. Now, Chris, I do want to say that there are certainly two things I would concede, and one of which is, Pat, to your point. If you put this in the context of imbalance, you get someone who already does this anyway, and if you hand out too many of these carrots, eventually one guy's or one girl has all this stuff and is suddenly way ahead of the rest of the party because of the fact that, look, they've got kids and a job and maybe don't have the time to do it or don't have the interest in doing it. I'd agree. That's a bad idea. As the game master, part of your job is to balance the desire of the players. Now, I would not hesitate to do this. I would be careful about how often I did it and how big the rewards were.
Absolutely.
The other thing that I would be very cautious about is you could get people who are minimalist, but achievement oriented. I'm not going to invest in this game. I'm not going to do Jack. But if you offer me a +1 sword for giving you a plot hook, I will give you a plot hook. I am still phoning in and uninvested and half-assing everything else in this game, but I will do the one thing you ask to get that reward. And that, quite frankly, is rewarding the completely wrong type of behavior. And if I had someone where my take on this was they're phoning in all the game except for the moments where I'm offering them an explicit cash prize, I would definitely say it's time to back away.
I think that's just step one in conditioning them. You got to take the long view. You get them under the condition of, oh, if I do this, a good thing happens. And then you start implementing more and more.
Or you can maybe make the goals longer term. That if you set a long-term goal for your character and give me 2 or 3 things that would hinder you from achieving that goal, and this is something you're doing in the background throughout the course of 3 months of the game, then obviously they have to keep bringing it every game.
Yeah, in that situation, it's all about creating the Pavlovian response. At some point, you get them into the mindset of giving you this extra stuff is a good thing, and good things happen when I do it.
It just sounds like a Benny system that you guys are overthinking.
I love Benny.
Make doing good crap the norm at the table, and when the crap is super good, throw a Benny.
Let other players throw the Bennies too.
Yes! Intra-player Bennying is awesome.
You say we're overthinking it, which probably in many ways we are. I mean, that's what this podcast does.
That's true. We're on episode what now? 200-something?
But I think the one thing that would separate this from most Benny systems is, even though in many rule books it will say, oh yeah, by the way, ultra reward metagame stuff, let's be honest, it almost never happens. And that's kind of what we're more heavily hitting on.
That's
here
true.
Is we're saying don't just reward them for slaying the dragon, reward them for having neat character moments before and after slaying the dragon, or reading up on what dragons are like and why they're in this world or something to that effect.
I meta reward crap all the time. You saw it in the original Goblins campaign.
Oh, yeah, and I think people should, but I think the reality is in a lot of campaigns, it doesn't happen as often as it ought to.
That's true.
I mean, how many times have you been in a game, and I've been in some, where somebody got a Benny for just making the table crack up? And I've been in games where that happened, don't get me wrong, but...
Yeah, it's called Tracy's Paranoia Game. I've been in one for probably the last five cons I've gone to.
Yeah.
It's just a Benny throwing all out, every man for himself war. It's amazing.
But yeah, I guess I've been lucky because I've seen that a lot, too.
I've also been in plenty of games where you didn't get the XP points or Benny or Magic Sword or whatever it was, except for in-game behavior.
They're not all bad. I mean, I prefer them as an element of the cake that is a game. But if it's not there, it's like using... two eggs instead of three. It does not destroy the cake. It just makes it not quite as sweet.
Yeah, it just could be a little bit better.
That's right.
If other players are throwing them out, it's just a lot better.
Yes, exactly. And maybe context demands that they not be there. If it's a super narrative game, then maybe Benny's might not have a purpose or a place.
It's one of those things, though, for me, and I think we've even mentioned this before on the mic. It's one thing to be rewarded by the GM, who is kind of like an authority figure above you, but to be rewarded by your peers, that means more to me. It means more to me have the person, sitting next to me at the table versus the person across the table.
Because throw a Benny at. They have a finite resource.
Yeah.
If they have three or four Benny chips or whatever the currency is in that game, and they give you one, unlike the GM, they're not the horn o' plenty, which can just put forth as many whatevers as they wish. They chose to reward you at their own expense.
When we played Chattel Tech, we had the octopus. And the person who was the best PC that game got the octopus at the end of it. And he got to hold the octopus throughout the next game, and it gave you, like, an extra edge or something. I think Chad retained the right to assign it as the GM, but it was done to the will of the popular acclaim 9 out of 10 times. It was a stuffed plush octopus thing, and that was fun.
I think doing things like that, actually, it creates a stronger bond at the table amongst the players. And I think that it, especially if players are handing that stuff out, because then it encourages a little bit more teamwork and encourages a better sense of camaraderie amongst players. Now, granted, if your table's not going for that and you want to be a bunch of backstabbing bastards, that's a different thing, but that's a different theme of the game.
And that's the juiciness of paranoia. You're all trying to kill each other as you're all handing each other bennies for making funny crap happen.
For our final topic, this is one that Wayne threw out, because we're actually seeing it in our current Battletech game. And incidentally, I'm thinking next episode, if it's not an interview or a bonus, we're probably going to go back to the group template here 5.5 years since the original group template episode. Because as we're putting together our current Battletech campaign, we are going through all these steps and trying to practice what we preach. But there is something that Wayne threw out that Battletech has brought up, which is, how do you help someone create a character for a campaign setting they're not familiar with? Because with Battletech, one of the things that I personally love about it is the complexity and the intricacy, and I think in many cases the believability, of all the historical, cultural, et cetera, information that's available out there. But the thing is, there's a lot of it. And while I did send Wayne some stuff that kind of gives quick primers or primers, if you prefer, on Battletech history, and were just short little write-ups taken from some of the source books that real briefly explain the history, this obviously doesn't necessarily give you enough to create a character from.
No, and in my case, I spent a week and a half to 2 weeks going through what you gave me. I had the Davian source book from Chad. I had the 20-year update, and I spent all of this time going through trying to immerse myself in the history, only to come to, you know, one major conclusion. When it came to creating the character, it didn't really matter. I love interweaving my characters into the back history, but for my first time playing in the world, the character's personality is going to be the character's personality, whatever setting he's in.
Well, and let me start by saying, I think that right there is probably the most important part, is to remember that while your character should have a context in the setting, look, I would still be me regardless of where you put me. Now, granted, where you put me would have an effect upon my personality and such, but nonetheless, a person is a person is a person. You can create a character without knowing anything about the setting. But let me put that thought on hold, because I think that's a bit of a platitude answer to a more complex question.
It's a realization, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and it's probably, in my mind, I think it's true, but it's probably not a sufficient answer for many people. Let's look at another person here, which is Pat's wife, Beth, who's playing in this game. I believe she's never played Battletech.
No, she has, actually, but she's not played in a Battletech campaign. She's played just basically skirmishes.
Okay, so she doesn't know enough to really understand the setting.
Yeah, to her, all the houses and, right, you know, this and the other mean nothing to her.
She's fairly busy, so I can't expect her to read through books and books and books of information.
Unlike Wayne.
Wayne, I'll have to give you a reward for that. I'll give you a free reroll or something.
I've been known to get a little obsessive about reading into campaign settings I'm getting ready to go into.
Here's the approach I have always taken with this in the past. If you have someone who is unable or unwilling to read the background material, and we have talked before on the show about how giving them a setting lecture is a quick way to lose someone, what I have always recommended to people in those situations is say, look, all I want you to do is to come up with an abstract concept of who you want to play. Here's the personality. Here's the kind of life they've lived. Here's the kind of drama they're currently dealing with in their life. And write what I call a Mad Lib character background, where all you do is you say, my character, you know, whatever the name is, was born on blank, a farming noun. World. Yeah, exactly. Now, a farming world with a mid-sized population. She was doing pretty well until she was conscripted by blank to
Lord
go
poop
to go to war against blank, at which point she walked away with a hatred for blank. Upon coming home, blank triggered a civil war on her home world, and you just keep writing stuff out. You know, she went to a very prestigious school, blank. Keep leaving these blanks where you know what you want, but you don't know where in the universe or what in the universe would allow this to happen. And so you just leave those blanks there, and then you trust that at some point the game master or another player who knows more about the setting will go back and help you fill in the blanks. I've done this many times at the Epoch of Rhysos, where I'm playing with a group of some people who have maybe played it a bunch of times with me and know the setting pretty well, and then a newbie. And they're like, I don't get it. And there's no book you can even send me home with. And they don't want the history lecture. That's just what I'll tell them is, hey, give me a Mad Lib, bring it back to me, I'll fill it out. And I think also in this is something similar to what we talked about with leadership, which is the game master and other players have to be very conscious not to crucify this person for things they didn't know. You can't say you grew up on this world and then destroy them for the fact that they lived on that world, which clearly means you're hated by the rest of the universe because nobody can stand people from that world. And the person's like, what? I didn't sign up for this. I had no idea what this meant. But do you guys have any ways that you've
playing
handled?
Fenton Realms was really hard, a hard way to learn that lesson.
I think related to that is a similar thing where the players need to step up and ask them, you know, what kind of things are you looking for with this character, and have player answer those questions. And then some of those answers in that Mad Lib form can be given in that way where it's, you know, maybe he does this off to the side with just the GM, or maybe they do it off the side with one of the players who really also knows the universe well. And then goes and works on things that way, and it just kind of gets refined out as, you know, as it goes along. But go ahead, Pat. I didn't mean to jump on you.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say
that conversation away.
To say that I think that sometimes a little bit of the, as you're terming it, the setting lecture is somewhat needed, but I wouldn't call it that. I would just say, depending on the setting, because like the ones that you're talking about, Dan, are universe settings.
Right.
I think in a Battletech, in an Epoch of Rhysos game, it's a lot easier to say you can be from anywhere in the universe probably and fit into this game. But if you're playing on a terrestrial game, like either a modern game or even D&D, where you are,
or ET 1984 Atari, that game was extraterrestrial.
There you go. Where you're just going to be basically in a small part of the world,
and then it was subterrestrial.
Yes, it was. And you know, you're playing characters that are basically from a country. You need to have some understanding of what sort of the local politics are like, or what the people are like, because like if you're basically playing in a Germanic area, you're not going to be say, well, I'm going to be a Japanese guy.
My name is Yonkel Goldstein.
Yeah. This is, you know, just as an example. So I think a little bit of that can be helpful for the characters.
Well, and you can
just
probably
help them
provide
that.
Them with some kind of reference points of saying, well, this culture is kind of Germanic. Well, I would say it's more of a cultural.
You know, that's what I was going to hit.
Give us some reference points.
Most settings can be distilled down into just a few sentence worth of description about the setting. Mm-hmm. There are some things I really did need to know about the BattleTech universe to create a character, but I don't need to know everything from all the books to
absolutely
do it.
Absolutely.
I need to know this is a feudalistic society. This is how they think about their mechs. You know, just the basic, this is what the setting is like, but not the in-depth details. All of that can be filled in as we go along.
Another approach I think you could take is ask them simply to give you a high-level template where you don't ask them for the full Mad Lib. You say, look, I just want you to give me 3 or 4 sentences on what you want out of this character, kind of generally what you're trying to get out of this character, and maybe tell me the kind of conflicts you want. You want interpersonal conflict. You want some kind of a lingering prejudice or whatever. And then I'll go back and I will write you a draft character, send it to you, and you can choose to accept or veto based on the line items. But we'll at least give you a starting point that I'll write for you. I'll simply tell you, this is who you're at war with. This is where your parents live. This is what you have going on. But I will work into this, the starting point that you gave me. I think it's going to go ahead and wrap it up for this episode. As I said, next time we'll be back either with an interview, a bonus, or a discussion of the group template. But one way or another, I think the next regular episode we do is going to be a revisit of Fear the Boot's second topic, which was the group template. Now that we've got quite a few new hosts on and several years of experience with using and failing to use our own idea. So I want to thank you guys for tuning in. And I want to remind you, as always, check the show notes for a variety of stuff. Have a great week and great games. And we will catch you next time.
See you
later days. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.